We are studying Esther, and kind of unusually, we've just got two sides of one sheet of paper. Usually I'm handing you something a lot more extensive. But there's a reason for that. I'll want to kind of go more through the details. Kind of like we did with Ruth, the book of Ruth, the story is just fascinating. So here's the book of Esther, and I want to give a little bit of background, and that is, Randy's been going through Nehemiah and Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezra and Nehemiah talk about the return to the land of Israel, right? And Esther is the one Bible book that talks about the Jews that stayed, right? These are the Jews that stayed once Babylon then was overtaken by the Persian Empire. And so this is the one account of the Jews that stayed. Now, some things that ended up continuing to have an impact on into the New Testament era were, one is, by the New Testament times, two-thirds of the Jews lived outside of the land of Israel. Okay? So this is a good portion of those Jews who stayed outside the land of Israel. Another thing is that those Jews that came back, as well as those that stayed, all had Aramaic then as their native language. So you had Aramaic commonly being spoken. That's why in the New Testament, even by New Testament times, you still have a lot of Aramaic coming out. Jesus said on the cross, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani?" My God, why have you forsaken me?" That was in Aramaic. Okay? "Maranatha," "Lord, come quickly." That's Aramaic. So there's still a lot of Aramaic left over from that. And one other thing, if you were one of the disciples and you spoke Aramaic, where could you go outside of Israel where you could find a lot of Jews who spoke Aramaic? In the old Persian Empire, right? So a natural place to go would be to go here to the old Persian Empire and to then be able to tell them the gospel and say, "I saw Christ resurrected, you know, with my own eyes. I touched him with my own hands." You could easily imagine them going from Israel over to the old Persian Empire and speaking Aramaic, and that's why a number of the apostles went there first. Okay, so now we have the book of Esther. Let me go through some slides here. There's some cool things to show you. Here is the Persian Empire, pretty extensive. Going into Macedonia, the edge of Greece there, on the northwestern part, down into Egypt, and actually including a part of Ethiopia there. And the Nile River continues down and actually comes out of Uganda, right? We'd cross over where the Lake Victoria dumps into the Nile. Every time I'd go land in Entebbe and then go over to Mbale, we'd cross over where the Nile comes out. And then you see it goes up north into even what's Afghanistan. And you see that, and then all the way over to India on the east. So a pretty large area. And so that was the Persian Empire, pretty extensive. Imagine how do you manage that big an area? I mean, you can't just call somebody on the cell phone and say, "Hey, you know, you need to up the tax rate a little bit out there." You know, if you have to send a message, I mean, even putting somebody on a horse, it's going to take a while to get word out, right? So it's quite a task, but. So there's the Persian Empire. Susa or Shushan. And by the way, why do you have differences of pronunciation like that? And we'll see it here in the book of Esther. Yeah, you have language differences, right? language differences. And so going from one language to another, because of the sounds that are included in the language, you'll have things will change. And we'll see here as we go into Esther that that's the case. So Susa is one of the language pronunciations, but also Shushan is another pronunciation, and that's the way it's spelled here in the book of Esther. So you have Susa, and actually Persepolis and Pasargadae were two other capitals. So the capital of the Persian Empire moved at different times. At this time, it was at Susa. Okay? So that's when we got boxed there. Here is an aerial of ancient Susa or Shusha. Okay? So that's the aerial photo. And right off to there, see that? Okay? That little structure looks like this. This is one of the places that's claimed to be Daniel's tomb. The tomb of the prophet Daniel. Okay? Now, before you get too excited, it's one of the places that's claimed to be Daniel's tomb. So a few different places. But what's interesting is that even the people that live there, and this is a Muslim area, have a high regard for Daniel. Isn't that interesting? A high regard for Daniel. So here is another shot looking at ancient Susa. Now, the other thing that came out of Esther was the Feast of Purim. And it is most Halloweenish of the various festivals. So it wasn't one of the seven feasts that Moses instituted. And the last one to be instituted was Hanukkah, okay? Between the Old and New Testament times. So here is one after the Feast of Moses. So Moses instituted seven. Then with Purim you have eight, and then Hanukkah you have nine festivals that they observe. Okay? And Jesus, John 10, 22, and 23, Jesus observed Hanukkah. Okay? But here is here's Purim, and they'll typically have very Halloweenish kinds of observances and celebrations, and they will have parades and noisemakers and things to eat and all that sort of thing. There have been several different movies since 1999, several different movies made, built around the story here that we'll be looking at this morning with Esther. And this is One Night with the King was one of them. This is Tiffany DuPont played Esther. And also some good background resources. There's some very good background resources. One is Dr. Yamauchi, who just retired as a history professor, but he wrote Persia and the Bible, a thick book, but he's got Esther all referenced in there as to the places that it applies. Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary, Volume 3, also really good on background, and the Archaeological Study Bible. So there's a few really good references that give a lot of background in history there. Okay. So let's step our way through this here. On the first page of your handout, what you see there is the events described in Esther occurred between 483 and 473 BC. We basically know how to nail it. And they fit between chapters 6 and 7 of Ezra, between the first return led by Zerubbabel and the second led by Ezra. So at any rate, the location, right between chapter 6 and 7, and the dates, those are pretty well nailed there. You have the chronology is first Ahasuerus, and by the way, there's another one of those pronunciation things. What is Ahasuerus' other name?
Xerxes,
right? So again, we go between one language and another, you end up getting different pronunciations. So Xerxes is the other name that you'll hear. That's Ahasuerus. Here's an example. We say Jesus, right? And actually in the Greek, it's Jesus, right? Or sometimes even Yesu. So different languages will have a different pronunciation. so we have that. In chapter 2, verse 16, Esther goes to Ahasuerus. And by the way, in the book of Esther, there's 10 banquets. Okay? And one of them is a half a year long. Probably what was happening is that it was a military strategy meeting that was, you know, extensive in time. And so the banquets would accompany, you know, these military strategy meetings. And then Haman, who's the bad guy, and he's the villain in the account, casts his lots. And the word lots, Hebrew Purim, okay? So that's where the word Purim comes from. Purim means lots. The I-am ending is how you show plurals in Hebrew. So Purim is lots, plural, right? And then Haman issues a decree, and then the date plan for the annihilation of the Jews. This is another satanic plot to wipe out the Jews. Okay? Why would Satan want to wipe out the Jews?
Jesus is a Jew,
that's one thing, yes. And why else? It's God's chosen people. Okay? These are the people through whom the Savior will come. These are the people through whom the Messiah, who will reign, will come. These are the people who, very few exceptions, wrote all the books of the Bible. In the New Testament, Dr. Luke is the only exception. In the Old Testament, probably the only exception might be Job. All the other books of the Bible written by Jews. So you have revelation from God over about 40 authors over about 1,500 years. But with a couple exceptions, they're Jewish. Okay? So if you wipe out the Jews, you get rid of a lot of spiritual influence. Okay? And you shake your fist at God. But guess what? Even though horrible things have happened to the Jews over the centuries, are they an identifiable people? Yes, they certainly are. As a matter of fact, it would be one of the proofs that the Bible is God's Word and that the Jews are God's chosen people is their continued survival. We don't know of any of the descendants of Esau, Jacob's brother. But of Jacob, there are millions. Even after all the persecutions and holocausts that have taken place. Some of them at the hand of the church. Okay. So here was this date plan for the annihilation of the Jews. Then Mordecai, who is Esther's uncle, issues his decree. And then you have following that in chapters 8 and chapters 9, the day upon which the Jews would defend themselves from attack. And then the 10 sons of Haman executed, the Feast of Purim celebrated. That's in chapters 9. Chapter 9, then 10 is a very brief one to finish it off. So this is over about a decade of time, okay? From 483 to 473 BC. So this all takes place over about a decade of time, this story. So what we have here, Esther is the one account about the Jews who stayed in Persia while a smaller minority went to Jerusalem in waves. And that the author speaks of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, in the past tense suggests that the book may have been written during the reign of Artaxerxes, the next king after, next ruler after. Though Esther does not state who wrote it, possible authors include Ezra, Nehemiah, or Mordecai, or another Jew who knew Mordecai and Esther. Rather amazingly, God is not mentioned in this book. Do you think that's bad? Does that make it bad? There have been people that have questioned it because it doesn't even mention God. Why would it or should it still be a Bible book if it doesn't mention God? Yeah?
It's kind of interesting because I think that was one of the requirements that the determination of which books were going to be in the Bible is that it had to have God listed, right?
Yes, in the New Testament, in other words, there was a different criteria for canon in the Old Testament and the New, right? So you're right. In the New Testament, they had different criteria because you also had a different group. You had apostles, so it either needed to be written by an apostle or by an associate of the apostles. Whereas the Old Testament, the criteria was at the end of the line of prophets, the last one being Malachi. The end of the line of prophets, the books ended. But let's get back to the question: Why should Esther be included if God's not in it?
I don't know how many other accounts were written about this time, but specifically, she was definitely a big part, and historically, a big part in saving the Jews. I guess that her intervention to the her closeness and intervention to the king. Really saved the people that were to be annihilated.
Yeah, otherwise they'd be executed, right? Yeah. One of the things that shows up, the name of God does not show up in the book, but one of the things that shows up is God's sovereignty. Isn't it interesting how God did critical things over time in what would otherwise be seen as precarious circumstances? You know, Jesus was not, for example, born into some very safe, secure, sure environment, was he? No, instead, you know, here's this guy, and he has to take his wife, who's pregnant, into Bethlehem, and there, in Bethlehem, the baby would be born, and they'd have a tough time finding a place. And then once the baby is born, Herod's going to come in and kill all the babies. So he gets, you know, Jesus and his mother out just in time, just in the nick of time to get away from the soldiers. And they head off to Egypt. It's a precarious situation, right? And this is another precarious time here with the book of Esther. And here is Esther just being kind of the sole instrument for turning things around so that the Jews aren't annihilated. That's just rather extraordinary. So God works in precarious situations and shows his sovereignty in this book. Yeah?
Do you know what tribe she was from?
I don't. Let me see here.
She's not in any of the genealogies, right?
Isn't she from Benjamin?
Yeah, I'm thinking Mordecai, who is her uncle, is identified as of the tribe of Benjamin. Yeah. So because of that, I'd logic it through. You know, she was her uncle, then she would likely be. One of the things that started to happen is that the Jews, by this time, were starting to lose track of their tribal identity. You know, once they got moved over, so that there is a possibility that somehow she was not. But implying from Mordecai that would have made her of the tribe of Benjamin.
Were women listed in the genealogies?
It was very interesting. It was not customary to list women in the genealogies until later. But initially, you generally kept them out. Key women are mentioned in some of the genealogies in the New Testament. You'll have Rahab and Ruth being examples, Bathsheba. But generally, they would follow the line of the man, right? Okay, so let's take a look here. We have Esther at a glance, and I think that kind of graphically gives us the idea. What first has to happen, how did kings and emperors in those days do relations with, you know, wives and women and all that? What was the standard practice? Well, certainly beauty was a big thing, okay? Pardon? Yeah, in other words, what they would typically have is a harem. Okay? Among the ancient cultures, you'd have a harem, that they would keep. So here is a kind of a pool of women, and sometimes that group of ladies would be very large. David and Solomon were not supposed to do so, but do you remember how many wives and concubines Solomon had?
1,000.
I don't know how you keep track of all those. I mean, it's like, what's your name again? You know? Yeah, where do all these kids keep coming from? You know? This would be a little hard to keep track of. But so they had this harem that they would work with, and then from that they would select a wife. Right? Yes?
So was it for political reasons as well, like with Solomon?
Yes, in other words, one of the reasons for having so many, and sometimes they'd go ahead and do plurality of marriage as well. That was not continued, by the way, into the Roman culture, but in the Persian culture, yes. One of the reasons for doing so is for political purposes. In other words, in order to make sure that I don't fight with you, I'm going to take one of your ladies and have her in my harem and that kind of thing, and that'll keep the peace between us. So sometimes it was done for political purposes. And Solomon is, of course, cautioned not to do that because the foreign wives would also bring in foreign religion. And that was a problem. Okay?
So then, since I don't understand too much about the book of Esther, why was she there?
Okay, let's take a look at it. We'll start stepping our way through it, and we'll see what's happening. Think of, how did the Jews get there in the first place? How did the Jews get over to this? Let's go back here. So here's Jerusalem way over on the west end, and then here she is in Susa. And what had happened is, under the Babylonians, the Babylonian approach was, take the people you capture and start with the leadership, but basically get everybody living in Babylon. keep them under our view, and keep them under our thumb. Keep them close. And so that was the Babylonian strategy. The Babylonians fell to the Persians. And this is something very interesting. The Persians had a religion of Zoroastrianism. And one of the key doctrinal points in Zoroastrianism is you don't take people from their homeland. Isn't that amazing? So as soon as the Persians came in, the Persians issue an edict, you can go back home. And matter of fact, it made them furious that the Babylonians had relocated people. Isn't it interesting? So that was a part of their religion. So that's why Esther and all these Jews were located there in the area of Babylon and Susa and all that. That's how the Jews got there in the first place. And so Esther was simply, because of her beauty, was one who was brought into the harem, right? But the wife, and that's where the story comes up here, the wife that was there present was Queen Vashti, okay? Queen Vashti. And so Vashti is now the queen, and where's the opportunity for Esther? Yeah, Vashti gets herself in trouble with the king, and she gets booted out of her position as queen, and there's the opportunity for Esther. Okay. And so here is Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, okay? And he's having this gathering, this royal gathering. This shows up in the first chapter, and then he gave the order. Then I want Queen Vashti here, right? And what does Queen Vashti do?
He doesn't come.
She refuses. You refuse the order of the king, right? Well, that's very shaming to the king. So he responds by, she's out, right? And then here is the opportunity for Esther. So in chapter 2, then, Esther becomes the queen. And it happens how? How does it happen that she becomes the queen? Anybody know the story here? Pardon?
Doesn't Xerxes just
kind of
fall in love with
him? Yeah, Esther then sees the opportunity and then is the one who is brought in to be queen. But how does she do that? How does she happen to come in?
Won't they send out an invitation for all the beautiful women?
They're gathering all these women. But now think of it. Could you, basically at any time, can you just walk into royalty, in the presence of royalty? Can you just walk in? Hi, I'm Vern, and, can I do that?
Have to have an invitation.
Right. Let's just take an example. Could I go to the, Queen of England and just kind of knock on the front door and say, hey, let's do lunch.
Sure.
Can I do that? Yeah. In this time, if you came into the room and the king did not hold out his scepter, you're toast. You're toast. And so that's why Esther's statement, seeing the opportunity, but also knowing that this is a bold and in fact risky move, she says, if I perish, I perish. So she realizes that this is one of those things, I have a great opportunity, but I also might die. So great opportunity, great risk. She might die in the process. Now, towards the end of chapter 2 then, with Esther becoming the new queen, Mordecai discovers a plot. Mordecai is her uncle. Mordecai had taken her in because her parents had both died. So here's Mordecai who has the opportunity to come into this royal area. Come in, it says, within the king's gate. Esther had not yet revealed her kindred and her people. Isn't that interesting? She hadn't revealed to the king, hey, I'm a Jew. Right? All the king knew was, hey, this is Esther, and boy, is she gorgeous. Yeah.
But wouldn't he know? I mean, with Mordecai and the fact that the Jews were there, I mean, why didn't he know?
I think that's one of the things is the acculturation. In other words, they bring the girls in. They are part of the harem. They've gathered all these ones in, and the criteria is, are they beautiful? And then, of course, there's the adaptation to the culture of the time, and one of the things that would happen is they would train up these girls and dress them and do everything so that they would be attractive to this Persian king. Right? So a lot of the individual culture would be put aside. Right? So you don't know, that she's Jewish automatically. She knows. As a matter of fact, what is Esther's Jewish name? Hadassah. Okay? So Esther is not her Jewish name. Okay? This is her Persian given name, and it comes from Ishtar. Okay? Ishtar. So that's Esther. So what you have here is Haman develops this plot, which comes to the fore in chapter 3. Okay? So Haman develops this conspiracy against the Jews. And so he's trying to get this put forward to the king so that the Jews will be wiped out. So that the Jews will be wiped out. And matter of fact, it says, chapter 3, verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all the other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Yes?
Why didn't he just say Jew?
Interesting, huh? Yeah. Why would he not reveal that these are Jews?
Because of the hatred toward the Jews?
Yeah, in other words, if he just says there is a people and they're doing this and they don't keep your laws, and you don't identify, okay, it's the Jews, it's the ones from here, yeah, how is that an advantage to Haman?
He's kind of putting the wool over the king's eyes in that sense of just being kind of lucid.
Yeah, one is, if he doesn't identify them except by their, you know, behavior, then he can avoid any kind of connections that might work against him.
So he's trying to be politically correct.
He's trying to be politically correct. Also, here's Esther, and she's not revealed to him that she's Jewish, but there could be an influence there, see? So he's being very crafty in how he's carrying this out, right? Yeah.
You can extend that. If there were people that were sympathetic to the Jews,
yes,
and not Jewish, but he could include those people too. He left it pretty broad.
Yes.
As to those who are not following his
law. Yeah.
He had free reign.
Yes, and following the laws of the Persians was very important to the rulers. Okay, boy, you better, you know, follow our laws, and that's the way it is. So that was very important to them, and so to have these people who are chronically following some other laws and not listening to the Persian ruler, that's bad. Okay? Yes?
Isn't that the same principle that they had with Daniel and also Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? I mean, they were not following the king's edicts, even though that was Babylon.
Uh-huh.
And so they were punished for that. I mean, this was, you know, a principle back then. And again, it goes back to the king.
Yeah.
What the king said, you did.
Yes.
Regardless of who you were.
That's right. Yeah. You better do what the king says. And so he's not wanting to identify them by their ethnicity, but only by their rebellious behavior, right? These people don't listen to you. They do their own thing. They've got their own laws, and they don't listen to you. You know, and that get them irked. Yeah.
But if they were brought there, then I thought the culture said they're supposed to send them back home.
Yes.
Once you identify them as Jews.
It wasn't an order you must go. It was an order you could go. And so, actually, the number of Jews who went back to Israel was a minority, not a majority. That's one of the reasons why by New Testament times, with a few different, you know, exiles and moving around, two-thirds of the Jews lived outside of Israel in other places, scattered different places.
Well, yeah. They were 40 years, right?
Pardon?
Was it 40 years that they were in Babylon?
Oh, more than that. Yeah, more than that. And as a matter of fact, if you stayed, you know, it was a lot longer than that. Okay, so was it 586? B.C., and we're talking here a century later, and these Jews are still there. So, yeah, they've been there a long time. And that 586 was the last deportation. They had earlier waves of deportation, like with Daniel and his friends. Yeah?
Wasn't that one of the complaints when they were going back to Jerusalem, that a lot of the people didn't want to leave their homes? And their comfort. And
yeah. You know, you think about it. You know, it was a big deal. Okay, now we got all relocated here, and we've gotten our life established here. And now I got to go and uproot, you know, myself. A lot of Jews just didn't want to do it. I've gotten, you know, relocated here, and we got a house, and we got all our stuff, and you know, we got a business going, and you know, it was a real pain to have to, you know, pull up stakes and go back and reestablish ourselves. And besides that, what's there in Jerusalem is a mess, right? I've got a life here that's established, and houses and possessions, and you know, I know all my neighbors. And if I go back to Jerusalem, you got people opposing us, and the temple's ripped up, and the walls are ripped up, and it's a mess. It's going to be a lot of work after I travel. A long time. So it's, you know, for a lot of the Jews, they just said, it's not worth it. I'm staying here. Yeah. I'm staying here. So now we have, here's Haman, comes up with this conspiracy. And then chapter 4. Esther, who is now already queen, agrees to help the Jews and to defeat Haman's conspiracy against the Jews. So, what's who are the players here? We got Haman as the villain, right? And he's developed this conspiracy based on behavior, not identifying the ethnicity. Based on, okay, their supposed rebellious behavior, because they have their own set of laws. He doesn't identify who it is, but just the behavior, and he gets the king to assign to him the duty of taking care of these people with the bad behavior, with their own set of laws, right? So then, Esther steps up and she is going to turn the situation around. In chapter 5, she holds another one of these, you know, banquets. Like I say, the 10 banquets in this. So she holds this this banquet. So she puts on her royal robes and sits in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat in his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So here Esther then brings this issue. In this chapter 5, Esther then brings this issue to the king. And in verse 3, the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half my kingdom." And by the way, that in ancient times, that was the way you made kind of an open promise, up to half the kingdom. And that was even done, remember when John the Baptist was beheaded? The offer was up to half my kingdom. So that was kind of a customary, you know, maximum offer. Up to half my kingdom. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I prepared for him." Okay, we're going to get Haman here, who's been delegated this authority to deal with the Jews, and we're going to bring this thing out in the open. Okay? We're going to bring this thing out in the open here. So, in verse 8, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Okay? So she sets up this banquet in which she's going to bring the truth out about Haman and what he's proposed to do. So it comes out there at the end of chapter 5, and then the tables get turned. In chapter 6, the king honors Mordecai. Haman is set aside. And so now Mordecai, Esther's uncle, gets to have a place of honor in the king's court. And in chapter 7, Haman is hanged instead of Mordecai. Now, when we say hanged, it's not as we typically think. What do we think of when we think of hanging? We think of a noose or a rope, right? That would be our concept. But what they called hanging was basically they would put up a pole and just impale somebody right on the pole. Okay? So that's what it means here by hanging. Not the noose, but just impale them up on a pole. So, yes?
So it wasn't really a matter of wiping out all the Jews. It was a matter of wiping out all the Jews in this particular location, right? Because a lot of the Jews were back in Jerusalem.
Basically, he was given you know, open season on any Jews anywhere. Because remember, what was he looking for is looking. He didn't talk about the ethnicity. He talked about the rebellious behavior. So anybody, anywhere, who showed this rebellious behavior would be a candidate. Anywhere in the whole, empire.
So he had the right to go back to the Jerusalem area as well.
Yeah.
He
yeah.
Set up killing back there as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. He could. I mean, obviously, it would have started there around, Susa. But yeah, he would have had free rein to go everywhere in the Persian Empire and wipe out the Jews. Yes.
So Jerusalem is part of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, you see, here's Jerusalem. It's part of the Persian Empire. It's on the way down to Egypt and Ethiopia.
And then right? Haman was just the king's right-hand man.
Think about it. If Haman comes up with this little account, he's informing the king about this, kind of rebellious movement that he's. Haman would have been seen as, hey, I'm an intelligence guy, and I'm giving you a key secret that's going to keep you in power. Yeah, and the appearance would be that Haman is a very well-informed guy, that he's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on, and he's detected this thing that's threatening the king. And so the king could just turn around and assign to him, well, you know who these people are, take care of them, right? And so the king then hands off the authority for Haman, who obviously knows who these people are and where they are, gives the authority to Haman to just carry this thing out and get rid of these people. Yeah?
What did Haman gain by, what was his idea of getting all these people out?
Yeah, let's think about that. What would be the advantage to Haman? Why would he be motivated to do this? What would be some of his motivations for doing this?
His own personal advancement.
Okay, his own personal advancement. One is doing this would put him in a position of power. Okay.
Did he get their riches though, and their property and?
Well, that's the other thing, is if you get rid of the people, who gets their stuff, right? And so this would make Haman wealthy. This would he'd have wealth and power. He'd be looked upon as Xerxes or Ahasuerus, right hand man, a very trusted fellow, and so there would be some advantages to him. Again, who gets all the stuff? Once you kill the people, is everything in their houses and got all their goods? And there would be power and wealth for him in carrying this out. As a matter of fact, the more he carried it out with, the greater the power and wealth.
So, how many he got?
He actually didn't get to carry it out, right?
So his plot. His
plot failed because through Mordecai and Esther's work.
He had to have begun.
So far as we know, he hadn't carried anything out yet. It was surfaced early enough that he hadn't carried anything out yet. So far as we can tell from the account. Yes?
How did Esther convince?
This was bringing things up at the banquet, and where this comes up at the end of chapter 5, chapter 5, verse 9. So Haman went out that day joyful with a glad heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand or tremble before him. He was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, and all the ways in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared, and tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king.
But he would have had to have known that Esther was a Jew, too, if he had the intelligence.
Yeah, what's interesting is at least at first she didn't surface that. She first, you know, gained the position and gained the trust before, you know, bringing this out. And so she gained his trust and favor first. So he had begun to gain this position, but not carried out anything yet at this point in time. So it was at this point a conspiracy and a plot, but it had not been executed or carried out in any way.
So here in the chapter it says to make the gallows ready. So the hanging gallows. So is it just a platform or is it just a stick? 50-foot stick.
Well, stick. Yeah, the gallows. In other words, it wasn't the hanging gallows that we think of, but they would suspend people up, you know, on a pole and hang them up on top of this platform. So he was preparing, but he hadn't actually executed any of it. But what was set up actually ended up being used for him and his sons.
The attack went forward, though.
Pardon?
The attack on the Jews went forward. And the Jews defended themselves.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Jews defended themselves. Chapter 8 says Esther saves the Jews on that day, 8 verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. And the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. Okay? So finally, she revealed, you know, here's how we're related, and here's who I am. Okay? And these are the people that Haman had gone against.
And basically, if you allow Haman to continue, then I am one of the ones that are...
That's right. That's right. So she finally surfaced, you know, Haman's out to kill my people, and I'm one of them, so he's out to kill me. Okay? So then it turns around, Haman and his friends and those who were about to carry this out, because he had set up a network, the Jews turn against them, and then they institute the Feast of Purim, a celebration that they had been preserved and they had actually gotten the upper hand over their enemies. And then finally, in chapter 10, Mordecai's advancement in the kingdom. It says, for Mordecai, last verse, for Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his kindred. So here, Mordecai was instrumental, along with Esther, in preserving the Jews. And one of the things that comes out here, again, that God is not mentioned in the whole book, but what you see is God's sovereignty in preserving the Jewish people through the work of Esther and Mordecai. Had they not had their place at that time, the Jews would have been wiped out by Haman. And
we already know that things happen as they happen, and that other people have tried to wipe out the Jews.
Yes.
And have not succeeded.
Yes.
So even if Haman was allowed to continue, he could have just been another Hitler.
Yes. Yeah. It would have been a Holocaust, right? Yep. It would have been a Holocaust. Now, so what you have here is continuing today is the observation of the Feast of Purim, Lots, as it's called. So the Jews celebrate that today. It's because Esther is one of their canonical books. It's the one that is added from the Old Testament, as we call it. They don't call it the Old Testament, right? By the way, does anybody know what they call the Old Testament?
Torah.
But, okay, that would be the five books. This would be the Torah, right? They call it the Tanakh. Okay, the Tanakh. So they don't call it the Old Testament, and, you know, they don't refer to it as Old Testament and New Testament like we do. So that's the Tanakh, that's their name. So they have the Feast of Purim commemorating this event where the Jews were preserved. There have been a number of times when the Jews have been at great risk over the centuries. And even in the 20th century, you know, with the Holocaust under Germany. But there have been a number of times when the Jews are at risk. And this was one time that was recorded in the scriptures. Can you think of, were there other times that you can think of where the Jews were threatened? Pardon?
Moses.
Yeah, and Moses' time was one of them. And remember what happened so that Moses was put in the basket? The Pharaoh said, kill all the, you know, male babies. Here we got people pressing their noses here, so we better let it go. Okay? Lord, we thank you for the study of this book. We thank you for your sovereignty shown in this book, where you used two well-placed Jews to preserve your people. And we just thank you for your love and care shown in all things. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.